There's a little bit of a larger turnout tonight than we got for Clement. Did you get a handout? So I guess you guys are more interested in rabbinic material than apostolic material, I think. Maybe not. Maybe it's the timing of the class. Summer's over, that sort of thing. Or maybe you've been listening to me for a few years and you're just confused. And you're hoping that this will help sort out some of that confusion, because I use all these strange terms and these strange words and these strange sources. And you're right. This will help. This will help. I mean, it won't solve the problem. It's not going to be the solution to all of it, because we're not going to learn everything here. We're going to just do a crash course, a quick crash course, in what you could call rabbinic literature. All right? And this is how I imagine this going. I think we're going to spend 6 weeks learning the basics of rabbinic literature from the Mishnah and the Midrash up through, including the Siddur and that sort of thing. There's two. All the way up through the classic commentators in the Middle Ages that you'll hear their names so often. The Rambam, the Ramban, the Rashi, that sort of thing. All right. So that'll be the first 6 weeks. Then for the seventh and eighth week, we'll learn a little bit about mystical sources and Hasidus, the Hasidic sources, which are more recent. So this should, we'll be covering a lot of material, be covering it pretty fast. There's a lot to learn. Basically talking about 2,000 years of literature that we're going to try to cram into 8 weeks. Okay? All right. I think of it like this, and it depends on your Christian tradition, but if you're from, different Christian traditions, I could throw out names that you would be familiar with. Like, if you're from, an Eastern Orthodox tradition, and I said, John Chrysostom, everybody knows, oh, Chrysostom. Yeah, everybody knows what we're talking about with, say, Chrysostom. Or if you're from, a Lutheran background, I reference Luther, right? Or a Calvinist background, and I reference Calvin, right? Or any of the reformers, any of the great reformers, right? These are things that just come with a religious tradition. They're bodies of literature that are communicated along with a religious tradition. If I mention Whitley and Wesley and these names, I mean, they should be familiar to evangelicals, right? So in Judaism, we have a lot more because we have a much longer, older tradition. So that's why and all of it sounds strange, and all these terms sound unusual. So we're going to try to start working on that. We're going to start today with the Oral Torah, what's called the Oral Torah. Now, I assume you know what the Written Torah is. The Written Torah is written by Moses. It's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And we call this the Torah Shebiktav, the Torah of writing, the Torah of writing. All right, and so that's what you're already familiar with, the Pentateuch, and you might not, until you start studying with Messianics, you probably never heard of this term, the Oral Law or the Oral Torah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Torah of the mouth is the way we. That literally translates the Oral Torah. You don't have to remember those Hebrew terms. Just remember the Written Torah and the Oral Torah. So what is the Oral Torah? Well, the Oral Torah is the theory that there is a body of legal material and an interpretive tradition that was given to Moses at Mount Sinai orally that he didn't write down. It's stuff he didn't write down. Well, he did, you know, even though he didn't write it down, doesn't mean we don't know what it is, because he told people about it. He told Joshua, he told the elders, and that sort of thing. It got transmitted orally through the centuries. And so on the one hand, you had what's in the written Torah, but then on the other hand, you have what has been passed on orally, and this is called the oral Torah. Okay, this sounds pretty absurd, pretty preposterous, especially to Protestants. Protestants don't care for that at all. Neither did Sadducees. And there's a lot of affinity between the two groups. But in any case, why would we have a problem with this? Well, we don't really understand, first of all, we don't really understand what it is we're even talking about. And when I learned with Chabad, the rabbis that I learned with, they explained it this way. They said, take tefillin, for example. You know what tefillin are? It says you shall bind them on, as a sign on your arm and between your eyes, right? You know, so it's these black boxes with the black straps with the Torah, these little scrolls of Torah in them and that sort of thing. It says, all the Torah says is you shall bind them as a sign on your arm and as frontals between your eyes. What is that supposed to mean? How would we even know what that means? You know, what does that mean? You're just going to take a Torah scroll and tie it onto your arm? Or how? What is that? If you didn't have a tradition that came with that of how to do that, how would you know? Or the mezuzah, for example, that you put up on the door. This is the other classic example, the mezuzah. How would you know? It says you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. How would you know how to do that? And so, you know, instead, there's a tradition that this is how the Jewish people have always done this. And so part of the oral Torah is just a contextual tradition that came with the scriptures. You know, that this is how you do stuff. I'll give you another example. In the Torah, it says, Hashem says, you shall slaughter, when you slaughter an animal, you shall slaughter it according to the way I commanded you. All right, but it does, nowhere does it say how he commanded us to slaughter, you know. This implies, and there's lots of instances like this. We give lots of examples, but people usually aren't convinced by these examples. So I'll give you an even simpler example. How do you know what day is the Sabbath? Well, it's the seventh day, obviously, so you start counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And it's sevens. The seventh day is the Sabbath, right? But here's the question. How do you know where to start counting? I mean, how do you know that, you know, Tuesday's not the seventh day? And Wednesday's the first day, right? Okay, so this relies upon an oral tradition. There's an oral tradition attached to this. Another example that we like to give is, how do you know what the vowels in the Torah scroll are? Since there's no vowels, you know, how do we know exactly, you know, because it's just consonants in Hebrew. How would we, well, this is from the oral tradition. We have an oral tradition. There's two of them. All right? Thank you. Yep. Or, better yet, and this is one of my favorites, how do we know what it means, what the Torah means when it says not to do any work on the Sabbath? Now, this is the classic example. In reading that in English, you would think, oh, I have to take the day off that, you know, from work, right? It means I can't go to my job on the Sabbath. But, you know, what I'll spend the day, you know, whittling, crocheting, and working in my garden. That's perfect. You know, you wouldn't know that whittling, crocheting, and working in your garden are exactly what the Torah has in mind when it says work. That's what the word malacha means, unless you had a tradition that came with it. So think of the oral Torah. One way to think of it is just the cultural context that comes with the Torah itself. Okay? That's one way to think of it. Another way to think of it, another aspect of it, is that it's the interpretive tradition, which means the way that we read the scripture. You know, you ever wonder why there's so many different denominations of Christianity and everything like that when we all have the same Bible? Well, it's not the Bible's fault. It's the way that we read the Bible, the way that we interpret it and that we understand it. And so in that regard, every denomination of Christianity is actually correct according to their interpretive tradition. You know? There's no denomination in Christianity that I know of that says, we know what the Bible says, but we're living in defiance of it. Instead, they're saying, this is how we understand it. And you have to have an understanding of a document. You have to have a community of faith has to have a consensus of a way to understand the document. Otherwise, we would all be at war all the time, right? Especially with a document like this. I mean, if every American said, I can interpret the Constitution for myself and determine what the founding fathers meant, and that's what's going to govern my life, it would be anarchy. You couldn't have a country based on that. You need an interpretive tradition, and that's what the Supreme Court's for, right? They are the interpretive tradition. Unfortunately, but that's the law. Okay, it's the same with the Bible. You could not have a fellowship of believers if they didn't have an agreed interpretive tradition. All right, so question is, what's the interpretive tradition of Judaism? Before there was ever a Christianity, there was Judaism, right? And that's something that comes from Mount Sinai, how we understand the written Torah. So the oral Torah, a good way to put it would probably be, the oral Torah is how the Jewish people understand the written Torah. Make sense? Okay, great. Well, this is really easy, isn't it? This is so much easier than you thought it was going to be. One of the important things about how to understanding the Torah and having an oral Torah that tells us how to understand the written Torah is that it helps us to determine halakha. And there's our first, 50-cent word, halakha. Halakha comes from the Hebrew word halak, which just means to walk. It's a verb, to walk. So halakha means walking. And it's very simple. It refers to the way you walk out a commandment. Halakha. So this is what I want you to memorize, actually, to know this word. And, I'll test you. There'll be a test. Very, very, very stressful, very stressful. Won't be multiple choice. It'll be fill in the blank. Maybe some essay questions. And So halakha is the idea of how do you practically fulfill a commandment? Going back to tefillin or mezuzah, how do you do that? What are the rules? How is that done correctly? There has to be a wrong way and a right way for everything. Well, maybe there's more than one right way, but there's also certainly more than one wrong way to do something. So the halakha is, the right way to do something. Now, immediately, a Protestant should object and say, hey, the Bible tells us what the right way is. But yes, but I understand that. I understand. But the interpretive tradition tells you what the Bible means. And the halakha is part of determining, the interpretive tradition is interested in determining the halakha. So this is very important. This is very important, for example, when we get, we don't understand how important, because we don't have a Sanhedrin, we don't have, people ready to flog you, and it's like a mitzvah for them, a commandment for them to do so, or to put you to death, or stone you, or something like that. If you break one of these commandments, as God says in the written Torah, in the written Torah, it says, anyone who breaks the Sabbath shall be put to death. Well, you sure as heck better know what it means to break the Sabbath and not break the Sabbath then, right? When you have a court of law has to like sit you down and say, okay, so what exactly did you do with these sticks? Now, were you gathering the sticks or were you carrying the sticks? This is a very exacting sort of thing. This is why it's necessary that Judaism developed such a litigious halakha. You know what litigious means? Litigious means what's another word for litigious? Yeah, too detailed. It's too detailed and concerned with minutiae, with concerned with legal minutiae. Why? Why is Judaism so concerned with legal minutiae? Christian answer, because they don't have the Spirit of God. Right? So they're just, they're just following the vain traditions of men. Actual answer, because it's a legal document. And there were courts of law that had to make decisions on all of these questions. You know? That's why it seems so litigious. Now, once the litigious ball starts rolling, it's hard to stop it, and it does become litigious. Needlessly litigious. There's no question about that. I'm not trying to hide anything from you here. Needlessly litigious and consumed in minutiae. No question. But there's a reason for it. There's a reason that it became needless. Never mind. So, that's the halakha. All right. If you're reading the New Testament, and you go back to the New Testament era, the days of Jesus, the days of the apostles, you will never encounter the words oral Torah. You can read the whole New Testament and never suspect that such a thing as the oral Torah existed. There's no oral law. Paul doesn't say the law. You know, sometimes Messianic teachers will say, well, that's what he meant in Galatians when he said we're not under the law. He meant the oral law. You know, this is not the case. The concept did not yet exist. It hadn't yet coalesced into a solid concept in the apostolic era. Instead, in the apostolic era, we do find this kind of terminology used for the same stuff. So, when speaking of Jewish tradition and rabbinic law, the New Testament uses several different terms. Traditions. Traditions of the elders. Traditions of the fathers. The customs. Jewish customs. The customs which Moses handed down. That's right in the New Testament. The customs which Moses handed down. And it's not speaking of the Torah there. And the customs of our fathers. And I gave you all of the citation material. That's the same thing. We're talking about the same thing. The term oral law hadn't developed yet, didn't exist yet, but we're talking about the same body of material here. Okay? All right. Did all of the oral law, is it reasonable to think, I have a copy of the Mishnah right here, just for convenience, this is the oral law. It's not oral anymore, as you can see. It's a big, fat book. All right. Actually, over here, if I could just pull these books off the shelf over here. This is Hebrew and English with a little bit of commentary. This is the oral law in written form. I got it. Don't worry. These are the 600 rules.
No.
These are the rules about the 600 rules. That's right. So, I'm making a point here. Yeah, that's a lot of books, huh? That's a lot to read. That's a lot of reading. Have you ever read legal material? Just law? You ever been to law school or anything like that? Or read, for example, the fine print on contracts or where it says, click here to agree to the terms and conditions, and nobody ever reads those terms and conditions. That's what you have right here. These are the terms and conditions. Yeah. This is the Mishnah. All right, so my question is it really reasonable to suppose that God said all of this to Moses? Moses just was like, oh, my hand's cramping up, and didn't write it all down, so he just passed it on orally. Of course not. Nobody really thinks that. Instead, as we read the oral law, what we find is a series of case precedents. You know what a case precedent is? Okay. Yeah. So a court comes to a decision on a matter, then later courts default back to that earlier decision when they face the same problem or the same question. And in Judaism, in the interpretive tradition in Judaism, earlier courts have greater authority than later courts of law, right? So, for example, Moses has more authority than Joshua. Joshua has more authority than the elders after him, and so on and so forth. It works like that. And so what you really have in the so-called oral law is a series of these case precedents of what this rabbi said, what that rabbi said, where the rabbis disagreed about it, and the conclusion they came to on that particular issue. And a lot of the issues are things like, you know, how much water is in a mikveh, and that sort of thing. It's details that you wouldn't be interested in, for the most part. Okay, so yes, it's a tradition, it's customs, it's legal precedents handed down by means of oral transmission. So, in the days of the apostles, you didn't have it written down. It was all oral. In fact, it stayed oral until about 200, around the year 200, as we'll learn in a moment. I have it all written down now. It's no longer oral. The oral law is no longer oral. But in the days of Yeshua, it was. And in the days of Yeshua, it was still, because it was oral, it was still, maybe you could say, more pliable. With differing people with different opinions. We see there are different opinions in here. So there was more room for discussion because it hadn't been codified yet, so to speak. But here's the question. Why if this is so important, if all these case precedents and everything are so important, why weren't they written down? Why was it oral? I mean, it was written down, but at the time of Yeshua, in the days of the apostles, why was the oral law oral? Why wasn't it written down? And the answer is that the scriptures were considered the holy writings. All right? And so what was written by Moses, what was written by the prophets, what was written in the past, those were the holy writings, and one should not add to them. So you keep it oral, you know, to make a distinction between what's written and what's oral. This is the same reason that our Master Yeshua didn't sit down and write a book. Yeah, he could have. You think about it. I always think, wouldn't that have been nice? He just like, hey, why don't you just hole yourself up in Nazareth for a year there and write us a book, you know, about how to do everything and how to be and what the secret to life, the universe, and everything is, and so forth. You know, that would have been useful. Yes?
So the Torah was written, but not the traditions.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Likewise, our Master's teachings were not written. The disciples did not sit and take notes as he was teaching. Instead, they memorized what he said. Only in later years did they compose Gospels. And in fact, most of our Gospels do not come directly from the disciples, they come from disciples of the disciples. So, because the disciples were following the assumption that they were learning from a rabbi, as Yeshua was and was teaching them, and as disciples, it was their job, this is what the job of a disciple was in those days, was to memorize oral tradition transmitted or oral teaching transmitted by a teacher and then transmit it to the next generation of disciples, his disciples. I'll show you this now. This is a passage from the Mishnah, from a chapter in the Mishnah that's called Pirkei Avot. We study it every year here at Beth Emanuel. Starting at Passover, we take a chapter of Pirkei Avot, one per Sabbath, study in the late afternoons, right? So you're probably familiar with Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot means sayings of the fathers. So this is the first verse of it, or the first Mishnah of it, is the way to say it. Moses received the Torah on Mount Sinai and delivered it to Joshua. Now we're speaking about the oral Torah here, okay? Joshua, in turn, handed it down to the elders.
From the elders it descended to the prophets, and each of them delivered it to his successors until it reached the men of the great assembly. Who are the men of the great assembly?
Ezra.
Yes, that's Ezra's school. Ezra and the returnees from Babylon are called the Great Assembly. Okay. So, in other words, Moses, he received this teaching, this oral teaching, he passes it on to Joshua. Joshua passes it on to the elders of Israel. The elders of Israel pass it on to the prophets. The prophet, and this is going generation to generation to generation to generation, all the way down through the history of Israel during the captivity in Babylon, and then finally ends up with the men of the great assembly like Ezra and Nehemiah and the great leaders of that generation. And they form a college, a school, called the Great Assembly, back in rebuilt Jerusalem. And they said to their disciples three things. They said, be careful in judgment. Raise up many disciples and establish fences for the Torah. All right, this is really the beginning of the formal oral law. Be careful in judgment. What does that mean? Well, anytime you have three rabbis together that are well-versed in the Torah and in the traditions of the Torah, if they're ordained, three ordained rabbis who received the laying on of hands from a previous generation of rabbis, they are qualified to form a court of law called a Beit Din. And then, as a Beit Din, they can hear court cases, they can settle disputes, they can interpret questions, and a lot of times the questions are going to be along these lines of the classic question, Rabbi, the cat was eating the chicken before I got it in the oven, and it was, and before that he was eating from a saucer of milk. Is the chicken still kosher? Can I, this sort of thing, and there's like, well, let's figure this out. These sorts of questions, right? So the men of the Great Assembly said, be very careful in judgment. Be very deliberate. Another way we translate that, be deliberate in judgment. Be exacting. Be detailed. Pay attention to detail when you are handling the Word of God and judging these cases. All right, so that's the first thing they said to their disciples.